But I am yet to attain omnipresent supergalactic oneness.
No. Wait.
There it is. You just attained it.
I have.
Yes. Just now.
You are one.
I can see it in your eyes. You're more one than anyone.
What about my medallion of spiritual accomplishment?
Take mine. This took you 80 years to achieve.
That's okay. I don't like it anymore. Really.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to another week of Muskies on Tap. Welcome to episode number 138. I'm one of your three Muskies on Tap hosts tonight, Gus Manti. We got none other than my brother Max on here. Also, the beloved Brian is here. Oh. And he's still making his appearances on, you know, we had our New Year's res pods, and Brian
there
said
he is.
Better attendance, and here he is. So, Brian, we'll start off with you. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Doing great. I'm, you know, surviving this cold weather, running my car all pissed off in between, you know, my work day and after work. It's not fun out there, that's for sure. But yeah, I'm gearing up to head down to Florida to get out of the cold kind of this weekend for a little work event. Supposed to golf down there on Sunday, but I just saw it's going to be a low of 28, high of 45, which isn't much of a difference from where I'm, you know, from Wisconsin, unfortunately. But yeah,
that's
kind of where I'm at right now. Spent the weekend watching golf, so slowly getting back into the golf swing. A new 18-year-old prodigy on the rise, too, on the PGA Tour, keeping out for Blades, Brown, situation pending there a little bit, so... Max, I know you watched a little golf. What's new with you?
Yeah, man, just trying to survive this tundra that we live in. You know, we're kindly reminded every once in a blue moon of the harshness that winter can bring. And yeah, man, it's just been running point A to point B when you're outside, just trying to get. You know, funny enough, per my New Year's resolutions, I'm not allowed to complain again about the weather. So, you know, I've been keeping things positive when I'm running into my office downtown Minneapolis and it's negative 30 degrees and the wind's blowing 40 miles an hour through.
Feels kind of refreshing, or what?
Yeah, no, it feels good. Good way to start the day on a high note. You know, really good mood.
That's funny you're doing your New Year's resolution. We're not even musky fishing, but you're prepping for it.
Yeah, you know? Just prepping for it. No, it's been good. You know, just been trying to survive the pond hockey too. The pond hockey schedule has not stopped, so we're out there, you know, pretty much in ice fishing gear trying to play hockey.
Lovely,
but no, it's been a good week, I guess. So. But Gus, we got a big interview on here tonight. Why don't you let the people who we got on the line here this evening?
We got none other than Joe Bucher. We got Joe on tonight with Joe Bucher Tackle. We chat a little bit on the new hand change for the the lineup of all his baits. You know, Joe Bucher Outdoors is now Joe Bucher Tackle. So we tackle that, and we also talk about a lot of Vilas County stuff, big fish stories, you know, then versus now, a lot of good stuff.
A lot of great stories.
Really good stuff. We had a lot of fun with this interview. We actually, I know this is the intro, we just got done with the interview not too long ago, and I think everybody's really going to enjoy this one. So we're going to be firing that one up here in a second. But first, want to say that this interview is brought to you by Thorn Brothers. They are actually, as I mentioned in the last podcast, actually the New York Muskie Expo is going on this weekend. And Thorn Brothers is going to be there. So all our out east listeners, you know, New York area, or you're coming down from Eastern Canada, go check them out. Go check out the
pick up one of them pound and a halfers.
Pound and a half, or
also some fun.
Yeah, that'll be good. You know, that'll help you get into the shape during the year. But yes, go check them out. And also, while you're at it, if you're, you know, on the interweb or something, you're just going www, just hit dot again, then say Next Gen Muskies at nextgenmuskies.com. if you want to sign up there, we encourage you to use MOT10 for a 10% discount. MOT10, MOT10 for 10%. That would be awesome. Support us, support Doug, and a lot of great stuff cooking up there. So be sure to check that out. And with that being said, we will bring you the interview here with Joe Bucher. All right, everybody, here on the line, we have a very, very special guest who is gracious enough to share his time tonight to talk about musky fishing and maybe a little bit more than that. We got none other than Joe Bucher of Joe Bucher Outdoors, Fishing with Joe Bucher, TV show. It's great to have you on, Joe. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, fellas. It's great to be with you guys, and it's always good. It's always fun to talk muskies and talk with different generations of anglers. And at this stage of my career, it's a lot of fun to still be part of it and to be engaged with people like you guys. And it not only gives me a breath of fresh air, to engage with guys like you, but at the same time, it's just one of those things. It's just so much fun to still be part of this industry and to have watched it all these decades from where it was when I first got into it to where it is today, and to see it in good hands and see all the different media venues that didn't even exist, right? I mean, just a few years ago, and who knows where it'll go tomorrow. But I'm appreciating the opportunity to be with you guys here today, and you go, let's have at it and have some fun.
Absolutely.
We typically jump around to all sorts of different topics, in these interviews. We're not the most organized of people, so we just whatever comes to mind that we're dying to ask or to talk about, we just spitball around. So I'd
It's
like
kind of
you were
like being out on the water for a day and you're fishing.
exactly, yeah. Yeah. Just cover a whole bunch of topics, but like you were saying, that you're still heavily involved in the industry. Like when we all started out, I think some of the first baits we own were had your name on it. Buchertail, that whole series of baits. We use it a lot growing up. So I'm just curious kind of your progression. We don't need to go through like, your whole scope in musky fishing, but if you want to jump into kind of how you started the business and when did that start to take off?
Well, I think what's fun to talk to you guys about tonight is that just recently, the guys that were involved in the business
Right.
for 18 years that called it Joe Bucher Outdoors, they retired, and we have a brand new team in place, and these guys that are in place right now are taking the company back to its roots and its beginnings. And I wanted to preface that because it's no longer Joe Bucher Outdoors. It's Joe Bucher Tackle, the way it was when my wife and I started it back in Eagle River. And
Oh,
yeah,
awesome.
so actually, we actually started in Boulder Junction, next door. And what happened, I'm sure you guys probably already know the story, but it's kind of like the bait company kind of started by accident. I was guiding. And I built, I was building my own lures, and I started out building spinners, and somebody caught a fish on one, and back in those days, you took, you knocked them, you clunked them on the head, and you took them back to the sports shop, you put them in the freezer, and the guy said, "What'd you?" The guy asked the client, the sports shop owner, "What'd you catch it on?" And just off the top of the head, the guy says, "Caught it on a Bucher tail." I did not come up with the name Bucher tail. One of my clients did, and that's kind of how the company started.
That's
And
pretty funny.
then the sports shop owner looked at me and goes, "Well, I can't call it a. You look like I can't call this a Bucher tail because I got a shop full of lures here, and if you're unless you're going to make some for me, and I'm not gonna put it down and call it that." And this guy said, "Oh, you gotta call it that." He says, "This is what this lure is better than anything that I've been using," and blah blah blah. And the long and the short of it is, I go home and tell my wife we got to start making some lures. So on the kitchen table, we bought some of the components and made a couple dozen Booker tails and took them into the sport shop. And pretty soon we started getting phone calls from other people, other sporting goods dealers and retailers and stuff saying, "Hey, I want some of those too." And that's kind of how it started. That's kind of how it started. And then it was, top readers and depth readers and shallow readers and slot master spinner baits and even back in the beginning, even with the Booker tail thing, making premium quality leaders was a big part of that at the beginning. So it's hard for you guys to believe, but when I first started, not only did we have 5 foot, 5.5 foot pool cue glass musky rods and Dacron line, but we also had junk leaders. There weren't good leaders available like there are today, all the great tackle we have today. And I started making my own leaders, and those were for sale too. And what's so funny about this, you guys are really getting a kick out of this, is back then, wire leaders for musky fishing cost about 25 cents. That's it.
Really?
But none of them were any good, right?
Jeez.
Fish were lost to broken lines, leaders that failed, wire leaders that failed, the snaps and the connections, all that stuff. So I made premium quality wire leaders for use in my boat, and I started selling those with the Booker tails. And I wanted, $1.50 to $2 per liter, and the retailers were just like livid. There's no way anybody would ever buy a leader for that kind of money. Well, look what we have today, right? And slowly
If
changing the
only.
industry, one step at a time, from even being an industry where, when you walked into a sports shop, even where you guys are, in Muskie country, walk into a sports shop and you have one little wall with, a few baits and a choice of one or two rods, and the rest of the sports shop was all kinds of other things, but it wasn't musky tackle. And when you get outside musky range at all, I mean, there was nothing. So, what you guys see at the musky shows and all this kind of stuff, it's like none of that stuff existed when I started. And so it's kind of cool to watch and see it all happen.
So what year did you make that first Booker tail then?
We started the company. It's easy to remember when we started the company because that was the year my son was born, 1978.
Okay.
But we started building them before, maybe a year or two before that. Mid-70s. And
What did muskie industry look like then in terms of baits? I mean, was there other sort of like MEPs out there, I'm guessing, but like what were you primarily throwing prior?
MEPS, MEPS was one of them. And then, all kinds of really small manufacturers. And here's the other thing, fellas. All of the majority, in fact, I'd say 90, 95% of the spinners, bucktail spinners, musky spinners were sold back then. The hair, bucktail was the big thing. That was the big thing. Natural bucktail was the big thing. And it was all tied right to the treble hook.
Oh, funny.
All right. Yeah, that's interesting.
Like all, some MEPS spinners are still like that, right? I mean, but that back then was like the thing. So if a hook rusted or broke off, or if you tried to cut, you ruined the lure. So one of the big things we did with the Booker tail, one of the first things I did when I was designing the Booker tail in the boat, was to make a interchangeable take, change out the treble hooks, not tying the hair to the treble hook and tying it to a shaft. In fact, we started out with just like copper tubing, and then graduated to lawnmower throttle cable, and that's what do people use today, right? I
That's pretty
mean,
funny.
yeah, it's the evolution of the whole spinner design. A lot of it has come off the original Booker tail. That straight shaft attaching the original Booker tails, by the way, no split rings. So we twisted the wire right to the treble hook. So when attaching a split ring came later, which We had to get split rings that were saltwater grade that were strong enough, because most of the split rings that you bought in the stores back then, fellas, just weren't strong enough and weren't trustworthy. But eventually, of course, when catch and release really caught on and people were cutting hooks and things like that, the lure was like perfectly designed for that. And you could change out the hooks, and if the hooks were damaged over, rust and corrosion or whatever, right, from sharpening, you could change them out. And that became a design that was then popularized, and you can, knocked off by so many manufacturers over the next 3 decades, 4 decades.
I just want to bring this up before I move on from the Booker tails, because I honestly think the Booker tail 500 tinsel bait is probably somewhat responsible for our muskie addiction, because that was a bait that we, when we got started out fishing the Eagle River chain, that's where our parents bought a place about 25 years ago, at this 20 years
It was
ago,
06.
06. So yeah, 20 years ago on this year. And we were throwing, spoons and whatever else. And then I remember when we finally first got our muskie setups, we got Booker Tail 500 tinsels. And that was when we started, moving fish, seeing bigger fish, catching bigger fish. And I mean, shoot, I don't know, Gus, what were like the two colors that we just lived and died by? It was that perch one, the
It was
gold perch one,
Perch, Gold Blade, and then Goldilocks.
Goldilocks. Those are the two that we threw religiously. I mean, still to this day, we'll throw them with,
Oh, you made my day. You made my day. Well, what you'll love about this is that, and I know you probably know him as my young protege, Chaz Martin. He came into my shop one day, and he came into my personal shop, my garage, and he says, "Dude, about every other time." "Dude," he says, "the 500 Booker tail, we're talking about the original." He says, "It's an okay lure, dude. But I need something that's size that I can throw with big rods and conventional tackle, that's heavier with heavier duty wire and a heavier hook and a heavier weight." He says, "And I want it with Flashaboo." He says, "Can you make it for me?" I said, "Well, of course I can." So, I twist him up the original 500 tinsel Booker tail, and he's absolutely ecstatic. How he gets excited anyway. He leaves. He's so fired up. About 3 hours later, he calls me and says, "Dude, I'm just smoking him on this bait." Chaz has had so much to do with the success and the development of that lure, and his encouragement and his desire to have that lure. It's I'd say it's one. It's his biggest success story, arguably, as the original Booker tail, because it took a small bait and made it big, made it fish big, right? And the original 500 was kind of built more as a pike lure, light, lighter rod stuff, and it's a lighter bait. And a lot of people still buy them, and we sell a ton of those, by the way, to northern pike anglers in Canada. But the 500 tinsel that Chaz Martin was so instrumental in pushing me to build. That's the dude. The dude got that going, man. So
dude.
you guys made my night, telling me about your success with that lure, and it's just great to hear stuff like that.
It's amazing. I mean, yeah, it's accounted for a lot of our first muskies and still muskies, and of course we could get into other lineups of baits. I got two things before we jump ahead on that or continue with the Booker tail. One thing that comes to my mind, which is hilarious, when you brought up the word protege, just recently watched the Seinfeld episode about the mentor and the protege. I don't know if people have seen that or not, but remind me of that. But I have a question on, so when we first started chatting here about the original Booker tail, and he said company started in, correct me if I'm wrong and heard correctly, 1978.
Yes.
Okay, so you said you were building some on your own, there's already, bucktails and what out in the market. So at this point, how long have you been guiding? And were you still kind of like a half and half walleye muskie? I know I've listened to other podcasts that you're in, and you talk about how you kind of progressed into becoming a muskie angler or a muskie guide. Like it was difficult to get people to get out and go muskie fishing. Kind of when give us a time frame on that.
Well, you know, which you guys probably know from, just it's obvious you guys know some of the history there, but when I first started guiding, like just when I got out of high school and first got into college, spend my summers up north, and both my grandparents and my dad both were big on Vilas County, and had a lot of history there. In fact, guys, my dad fished up here up in your neck of the woods in Wisconsin when there were still moose up there.
And like,
Wow.
can oh my jeez,
I know, it's incredible.
they barely see him. I don't even,
Well, yeah, he went.
mostly the UP now.
Yeah, he tells me about all the time. When my dad used to tell me when I would take him on trips up the Nisqually chain and Palmer and Tenderfoot, he goes, "Oh, saw a moose over there, back in, '63 or whatever." So, that takes us way back, But when I first started fishing up there, when I show up at a sports shop, the sports shop guys say, "You should really think about getting into guiding. You're really good at this." And I thought, I don't know if I really want to do that. And the long and the short of it is, I agreed to do it 1 year, and $25 a day, guys. That's what I was making. $25. Yeah, gas was like 20,
Oof.
yeah, gas was $29.9. And when I went to $35 a day, I was expensive.
That's a
So,
big jump.
but back then, there were very few serious musk anglers. And you made a living as a walleye guide. And back then, the walleye fishing in northern Wisconsin was terrific, and it was a great way to make a living. But what I would do a lot, one of the big things with the guides back then is they would, and I was part of this, is you would take clients out, and we fished a lot out of American Plan Resorts, which I don't know how many even exist up there anymore. And if you, yeah, are you familiar with the whole American Plan style of resorts and what they really are? What they essentially are is or were was you lodging, food, everything was included. And
Okay, yeah, because
some of the
that kind of
Canadian,
died now.
yeah, well, the Canadian places are still very popular, right?
Yeah, okay.
With that. So part of your package at those places was guided trips. And you would take, pick up a client at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then at lunchtime you'd cook a shore lunch, by the way.
That's
So you had to cook
awesome.
something to cook for a shore lunch. And then afterwards, I'd say, you guys have had a good morning walleye fishing. You want to cast for muskies for a couple hours. And that's how it started. And so, you take these guys out for an hour or two, and once in a while we'd have some success, and pretty soon these guys were like, "I think I'd rather do more muskie fishing. Just get enough walleye fishing in to catch, to take some fish to go home, and I want to do this muskie fishing." And I would promote it and promote it. Now, at the same time, I was writing. Now, writing back then, guys, unlike the podcast, for example, which is popular now, back when I was your age, writing. I was writing for Fishing Facts, The End Fisherman, Midwest Outdoors. That was how I promoted my guide business, and people stood in line, for that issue of Fishing Facts and The End Fisherman and everything to come out. And eventually, as you guys know, I started my own magazine. That was a muskie magazine, Muskie Hunter Magazine, for that reason. And anyways, that was a great way to promote the guide business and promote, muskie clients. And so I would do a lot of walleye articles because they wanted more walleye and bass articles than they wanted muskie articles. But every once in a while, I put a muskie article in Fishing Facts or The End Fisherman and Midwest Outdoors, and I promote my guide business, or the editor would help me promote my guide business, and I'd get quite a few clients from that. And then I started speaking at shows and whatnot. And in fact, my first muskie seminar at a sports show was the guy who was going to speak got really sick, and I was there as kind of a guest in one of their booths. And they came up to me in my booth, said, "Hey, can you fill in for this guy and do a fishing seminar?" So I'd really never done much fishing seminar, so I go up and I do the seminar, and the rest is history, right? I end up speaking at sports shows for 41 years straight until the COVID thing happened. And I went up there and I pitched the muskie thing really hard, and I got everybody in the crowd excited about muskie fishing. And people started coming up and booking guide dates, and we started bringing our lures to these sports shows and selling them there direct, and then getting business off of that. And that's kind of how it started, lure company, muskie magazine, guide business, writing, and eventually television. Originally I was a guest on other television shows. That's how the TV thing started. Back when I was your age, I was a guest on a lot of television shows. And one day I was fishing with Roland Martin. You guys know who Roland Martin is?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, well, he came up to film a show with me. We filmed seven shows in 3 days. And we filmed every species imaginable. We filmed crappies, walleyes. We caught 211 walleyes in one afternoon off of one reef.
Jeez.
Oh, I
Come
mean,
on.
all on grubs. Just, we were on this, I named the spot after him, called it Bar 205. We caught 205 walleyes off the one reef. It was just amazing. But anyways, he looked at me and goes, "Son," he said, remember he used to say son all the time. He
Yeah.
said, "Son, you ought to get your own show. You're pretty good at this." That's how I got in the television business. Roland Martin kind of, encouraged me to do it. Little did I know what I was getting into. And 30, over 30 years on broadcast TV, and that's kind of part of the big success of my career was the whole television thing, which ended up going nationwide and internationally on Outdoor Channel and Sportsman's Channel and the World Fishing Network and all that other stuff. It was a fun time, but that's why I say I've got so much to be thankful for being part of this industry, and I'm always very excited and willing to be involved with and talk with guys like you, and not only share the things that went on in my life, but how I got to where I am, but try to help you guys along and help the industry where I can.
So what was a day on the water like with a young Joe Bucher as your guide when you got into the muskie game like full time? I mean, I've read the book Time on the Water. You're referred to quite a bit in that book as somebody who just was always fishing
Yeah.
and was always out there. And so, I'm sure maybe things look a little different now when you go out and muskie fish, but what was a day on the water like with Joe Bucher when he was guiding every day for muskies?
Well, when I really got intense about the muskie thing, one of the things I did, I there was a couple things that people that have fished with me a lot would be chuckling listening to this, because it's, and I'll fully admit it, I was a dictator. It's my way or the highway. I said I would be fishing with people that, I said, "I don't care what you do for a living. I don't care how much money you make. I don't care how successful you are. When you get in this boat, I'm the captain of the ship." So when you see now, I had to do that, fellas. You'll really like this, because when I first got in the guide business, the guides were rowboats. You just rowed a boat around for everybody, and they told you where to go and whatever. I said, "That's not the way you're going to fish with me." I said, "When you go with me, I'm going to call all the shots. I tie all the knots. I check all the drags. Everything, it's a dictatorship, and I'm going to teach you how to become a good muskie fisherman. Because if you teach people how to be good anglers, they're going to make you look good, right?" So, that was a big thing. So I try to teach my anglers to be good anglers, to be really good. And that's, of course, where, the writing, the speaking, eventually the television and everything too. But it's the teaching, it's the education, and as you see now, it's like, it's proliferated the whole industry with, I mean, you can find figure eight videos, but you can find thousands of them, right? But back then, nobody figure eighted guys, and everybody, there's people sat down in the boat. I said, "You're not sitting down in the boat. You're gonna stand up. Yeah, you're gonna figure eight after every cast. You're gonna figure eight after every single cast."
Well, Joe, they still ask
Yeah, and there's no follow. I said,
that
"You're going to trigger fish to
every
follow that the strike that you don't even see follow." Which, all those things, they're more believable for you guys because you're hardcore muskie guys. But you can imagine, what I was up against. But think about this too. Like after, 5 or 6 years, I developed this clientele. I mean, man, we were something else. think about it, at the end of my, towards the end of my guiding career, there was a contest. It's probably not around anymore, but it was called the Vilas County Muskie Marathon. Big deal back then. You know, if you caught a muskie that was in the Vilas, the top 10 of the Vilas County Muskie Marathon, that was a big thing. My clients would put between Tony Rizzo and myself, we would dominate that. You know, and there was one year where I had seven fish in the top 10. And there were a lot of years where it'd be two or three or four, and there'd be quite a few years where we wouldn't get the top fish, top catch and release fish, you know, the top kept fish. And those were clients. You know, those were clients that just started to have so much success because they became good anglers. I put them over good fishing, but at the same time, you know how it is. I mean, if you guys you take friends out, you take if you guys are doing a lot of guiding, you know that you can put people over fish, but there's no guarantee that you know. I said it all the time. I still say it today. You know, well, back in the end of my guiding career when I was making about $300 a day, which was a lot of money back then, right? And I was only fishing about 4 hours, and you know, the guy said, "Well, for that kind of money, can you guarantee fish?" I said, "Yes, I can guarantee you that you'll be over muskies. I cannot guarantee that you may catch them." And right?
Yeah.
If you
Ain't
think
that the
about that,
truth?
right? Yeah, I can guarantee you guys can guarantee you're going to be over some fish. But do you have the skills to trigger them to strike and to do all these things, you know, to get to catch the fish? And you can take this the same old, it's like you can take a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And it's the same thing with anglers. Skills are such a big part of the game that so many anglers today have the skill, have these skills, but boy, there was a time, fellas, when very few anglers had these skills. And so my group of anglers that I fished with, those guys were so, they were angry with me at the end of my guiding career when I got out. I wanted to get out of the guide business because the TV show was going so well. I didn't have enough hours in the day to do all these things. So it was like, you know, I got to give up something. I gave up, reluctantly gave up the guide business because I had the television show going full time. The tackle business, you know, was going full time. Editing a magazine, all this other stuff. And my clients were absolutely livid with me for a number of years when I got out of the guide business because they were so, you know, dialed into fishing with me every year.
Yeah,
What
that's a good thing.
were some of the just I'm a huge I'm always really interested in Vilas County muskie fishing in that time period that you were guiding. And so
Yes.
you mentioned the the annual top 10 muskies, and you're saying, you know, you have clients on the board, you know, year in and year out. What were some of the sizes of those fish that would typically make the top 10 for that contest?
50s, 50 plusers, baby. It was pretty, it was amazing. You know, it's really amazing. You know, high 40s. You know, you got to realize that there was a time also that pre-catch and release when it was all about weight. So you weighed them, right? And it wasn't about length. And in fact, the length. You know, in fact, fellas, one of the biggest muskies I ever guided a guy to was 49 and a half inches and it weighed 44 and a half pounds.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's an
So
unbelievable
it was
dimension.
1985, and I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with the 1985 Bears, Chicago Bears, and William the Refrigerator Perry. Okay. So we, you know, that fish was nicknamed the fridge, the refrigerator man. And, it wasn't even a 50, but it was 44 and a half pounds, 49 and a half inches. So, you know, but most of those fish that were top teners were 50 inch class fish. And the biggest fish ever, you know, in my boat in Wisconsin was 54 and a half in Wisconsin, which is a really big fish anyway, anywhere. But in Wisconsin, you know, 50 fish over 53, 54 are really, really rare. And what's really neat about beyond even the top end fish were some of the, you know, some of the weeks we had, you know, with I had one client from Chicago, client dad, father and son. We caught 21 muskies in 3 nights on North Twin when I first started doing the night fishing. And they fished at me like 3 times that summer, and they caught those two guys caught almost 50 muskies. You know,
Jesus,
just yeah,
it's
all on death radius
unreal.
after dark. And I remember that specifically, remember that summer because that was the greatest summer I ever had on North Twin that night. I caught 200, I think it was 205 muskies between 4th of July and Labor Day, between 4th of July and Labor Day,
Oh,
205 fish. And if
it
you just you do the math, you know, in about, you know, 60 days there, you know, we were just banging them, man. I'm just, and you know what?
sickening.
There was nobody out there doing it then.
Well,
Right.
that's kind of my next question is like, you see all the times in chat pages and Facebook and in person, you hear people talk about how pressure is just kind of ruining the sport or making these fish, impossible to catch on certain bodies of water. I mean, how much a believer in that are you? And then what are kind of the differences from back like that summer you were talking about compared to what it's turned into now?
Well, you know, it's a constantly evolving sport. There's no question about that. And you know, it's no matter what you do, no matter what you fish for, whether it's bass, walleyes, or muskies, it's a constantly evolving sport. And back then, fellas, there were a lot more shallow water target fish. There were a lot less anglers. You know, especially even without catch and release, there were still plenty of fish. Because there just weren't that many guys targeting them.
Right.
You know, it's you know, now what even you know, 15 years into my fishing as a guide, especially once I got popular, especially once the television show hit the air, then it was crazy. But you know, in the beginning, you could hit all the spots. You know, for example, I had to go on, you're talking about the Eagle Chain, the Three Lakes Chain. You'd see one or two musky boats the whole day. You see a lot of boats, but you would see one or two musky boats the whole day. You know, and there were very few people really dialed into hunting big fish, especially. So it, you know, today's world, it's really different. You know, what you do have going for you today is what you do have going for you is catch and release. What you do have going for you is technology. Sometimes, arguably, technology to a point where it's people are talking about it all the time about forward-facing sonar and all that kind of stuff. That's all kind of evolved. You know, that's not only putting lots of pressure on the reef on muskies, putting lots of pressure on all kinds of fish. You know, there's guys. You know, I was doing a podcast with somebody last week. And the big subject was, and you aren't going to believe this, but down, you know, I fish a lot of saltwater, right? One of the big things down in saltwater is drone hunting for schools of fish.
Yeah.
So
No
these guys are
kidding.
out,
Wow.
they're these guys are in charter boats flying their drones around trying to find schools of redfish and go, oh,
Yeah.
2.3 miles from here, get pull your lines up, pull your lines up, we got to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you know, it's
Jeez.
yeah, I know. When if you can imagine being a young Joe Bucher in the 70s, early 80s, having no concept of what the world was going to be like today with all the musky tournaments and all the things that are, you know, all the pressure and everything that's going on. There wasn't anything like that, fellas. So you could go back on a fish and work it. Three, four. The only pressure you had was from other guides. You know, there'd be a, if there was two or three guides on a body of water, you had to watch out for him going up on your fish. But there are, what's also interesting, and that this is another thing that's really lost in today's world, is there was an etiquette that existed back then that doesn't exist anymore. You know, you're up on a reef fishing walleyes. You're drifting over a weed bed and you're catching for muskies, and you know, guide would drive by and wait, go hit another spot. You're in a weed bed now, and guy'll pull right alongside you, right behind you, right in front of you, and keep it, you know, it's the way it is today. And It's frustrating for you guys. It'd be nice for you to step back in time to be able to go back and see what it was like when I first
Yeah,
started.
certainly would.
But at the same time, I have evolved myself. Where a lot of anglers complain today, not that I never do. You know, if Chaz will tell you that he's in a boat for me, I'll go, "Uh-oh, Joe's in a bad mood today. Must be a lot of guys fishing around us." But I have evolved. Just if you're going to be consistent from one decade to the next, and you're only as good as the last fish you caught, and you have to constantly get better. And about the time you think you know everything, you don't know anything. When I was inducted into the Hall of Fame, I was the youngest inductee at 41 years old. And boy, I really thought I knew something, right? I look back at what I knew when I was inducted in the Hall of Fame and what I know now, 30, exactly 30 years later. My gosh, I know way more now. So it's you. I guess my best advice to people is, you know what? It is what it is. You got to deal with it, and you have to come up with ways to be. You have to come up with ways to overcome it. And one of the ways I overcame it, by the way, was night fishing. That's why I did a lot of night fishing, in the late 80s, early 90s, because I had to figure out ways to overcome the crowds. And boy, when I went out after dark, I beat the crowds.
Right,
Yeah.
what were some of those stories real quick of the fish, back when you first started, they didn't have any pressure. I mean, how different were fish acting then compared to today?
They acted more like Canadian fish. Where you raise a fish,
It's gonna eat.
you come back and they're going to eat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you could go after a fish for days, for weeks, until you finally got a hook into them. At the same time, again, no guarantee you catch it because the tackle we dealt with back then was always a challenge. I still remember. I still remember. One of the greatest things as a guide was take is taking somebody out and then them catching one of these first muskies, biggest muskies. I was with Jim Sirik when he caught his first 50. He was with me. Jimmy Sirik was a client of mine. Jim and his dad were clients of mine, and I'll never forget when Jim caught a big muskie with me, a 51 and a half. His first 50. But that fish was caught, by the way, on 27-pound Dacron, old style tackle. We fought that fish all over the lake because you couldn't put a lot of pressure on them back then. You can't put a lot of pressure on those fish with 27-pound Dacron, and you had to retie the line every 30 minutes and all that kind of stuff. But that fish that Jimmy caught was a fish that lots of people knew about. Nobody could get the hooks into them, and just happened to pull up on that spot that day. That was caught on a lake called High Lake. You guys know where High Lake is up there, the Boulder
Yeah.
Junction area? Well, that was caught on High Lake, and I fished on High Lake and fish trap a lot in those days because a lot of my business was out of a lodge on that lake called Forest Lodge, which was a big American plan lodge back in the day. And so I knew the lake really well, but that was gosh, I have to really do a book on the big fish catches and the stories of that kind of stuff because I've written about a lot of them. You've seen them in photos, catching them in snowstorms, catching them. One of our greatest catches that was a top 10, a top five muskie guys was caught on walleye tackle. Fought him for 1 hour and 20 minutes.
Oh, goodness.
Fought the fish on 6 pound line for 1 hour and 20 minutes. Followed the fish around forever, forever, and
That's like a
then got
tarpon.
the fish. You got the fish in the net, and the fish blew a hole through the net, and we still caught that fish. I still can't believe it to this day.
Did you jump in?
No, you know what? It was like, I think at that point the fish was so tired that even though that it should have been complete panic, the fish was still on the end of the line. So it just kind of pulled the fish back and reversed the net and folded it over the fish again. And then I just reached down and just, you know, kind of bear hugged the fish with the broken net bag, and, you know, just kind of bear hugged the fish like a cradle into the boat. And that was a top five. I think it was maybe number two or number three that year in Vilas County. And that was a 6-pound test jig and minnow fish.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Fishing walleyes. And we were going.
Of course. Of course. Well, so Joe, I know we've kind of brought up a little bit of some comparisons to now and then on musky fishing. One thing I do want to ask, and I don't know if you have like a maybe answer in like a 5-year period or a decade. What do you think? I don't know how much musky fishing you do like now, but you know, up until you were still heavily musky fishing from when you started, when do you think the golden age was? We've heard this answer in a lot of different ways. You know, we've talked to anglers our age, all the way, you know, to your age and older as well. So we've heard a lot of different answers, or, you know, myself personally just asking people. So I'm kind of curious, what do you think your thoughts are on the golden age of musky fishing?
Yeah.
In Vilas Oneida County, I should say.
In Vilas Oneida County?
Yeah, up here. Yeah, we'll leave, like, Canada out of it.
Yeah, yeah. In Vilas Oneida County, there's no question it was fabulous in the 80s. The 80s, 70s and 80s. Yeah. 70s and 80s, it was the best.
Yeah.
It was just fantastic. Probably was really good in the 60s, too. You know, 70s and the 80s, and what happened in the 80s is, you know, the tackle got better, but there were still lots of good fish to catch, and everybody was catching. There was a ton of catch and release. And people were taking care of the fish. The sport was cranked, and, you know, I think that, you know, the Vilas County Musky Marathon proves that the 80s were just the 70s. In the 70s, you know, there were 40-pounders caught every year. You know, there'd be three, sometimes four fish, you know, dead weighed 40 plus pound fish every single year out of, you know, North Twin, Vieux-de-Zaire. But think about it. I mean, there was a time when Vieux-de-Zaire was like, you
just
know,
pumping them out.
Reverence. you spoke that name with reverence, you know.
Yeah.
Pound tigers, you know. You know, legendary, the guides before me, that were involved in some of those legendary catches on some giant tigers and some big fish. Good grief, those were some big ones, you know. So I would say, I don't know if it varies with other people you've talked to, but from my perspective, yeah, it was the 70s and the 80s were really the heyday of that area. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that, and you asked how much I still fish a lot. I fish for muskies. I still fish a lot. I fish, you know, fish a lot. Usually, by the way, I'm down south right now. I'm on the water every day catching big redfish, and, you know, which are absolute gas to catch. And all, you know, those, you know, it, that's just, a, that's a whole new world, but it's a lot of your musky, a guy who's a good musky angler can go out and catch any fish in fresh or salt water because you have the tenacity and the skills. The musky angler's tenacity is second to none. You know, and that's why so many guides, no matter where you fish in the world, when they find out you're a musky angler, they're like, oh, I want to fish with that guy because, you know, that guy's going to stick it out. You know, he knows what it takes, and he's not going to be complaining every 10 minutes or every hour about how many fish he's catching. But, you know, to answer your question, you know, it's, I experienced all of it, you know, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s and the 90s, the 2000s and beyond. And as you, what you did see, even with all the catch and release, you did see the lack of 50s. The lack of 50s.
Interesting.
Right? And you see the lack of 50s. You talk about catch and release all you want, but the lack of 50s. That were part of the 70s and 80s, you know, what happened to them? You know, you can see that happens in a lot of, even outside of musky circles, you see things like that happen where Look at the history books, fellas. You look at the Chippewa Flowage and these big muskies and the Hayward area and these 50 and 60 pounders that just post-World War II, the late 40s and early 50s, man, that area was pumping out these record class fish, right? And it never happened again. It never happened again. And you have all these good anglers out there now. Now, you see these areas where they're pumping out mid to high 50-inch fish, a few of them every year. And that, those are, and Minnesota's as good as anything. In Minnesota, by the way, when I was your age, there nobody talking about Minnesota. Nobody, nothing. I mean, the Lindners were fishing a few bodies of water up there, but they weren't catching any fish bigger than the ones we were catching.
Crazy to think about now. I mean, it feels like it's two different worlds. You know,
It is.
I live in Minnesota now, and I've started fishing Minnesota more regularly, and I still personally love going to Vilas County. I mean, I know we talk about pressure, and there's certainly a lot of it in Vilas County, but it is after fishing more in Minnesota now. You know, Vilas County to me is still one of the few areas you can venture out and beat the crowds because there's so many bodies of water to fish. And the one thing I'll pay Gus a compliment is a younger guide in that area. He's done a really good job at fishing so many different bodies of water. I mean, when Brian and I go up and visit him and do our fishing trips, you know, we're fishing multiple lakes a day. We never really hit the same stuff in over year during trips. So it is still, you know, the one place where you can find some hidden gems or just lakes that maybe haven't been touched as much lately. And you're out there at 7 p.m. on a Saturday, and there's very few people around, you know, in certain areas. But yeah, it is definitely changed. No doubt about it.
No, you're right, and the dude is part. He's doing really well up there fishing those bodies. Well, now you look at Chaz's knowledge and his success and all the success he's had and his skills and he's caught a few 50s, a few. Now, and what I mean by that is that where I'm going with that is that, and I've said this to so many people, that will put one individual on a pedestal because he's caught so many more big fish than this guy. And I said, switch the bodies of water that those guys fish. And that guy with all these skills, that Chaz Martin, okay, that Gus, you take these guys, you put them on a body of water with a whole bunch of those big ones, and guess what? And you take that other guy who's been catching all the big ones and put him on the same waters that Chaz and Gus and you guys are fishing. And guess what? He catches the same size fish you guys are catching, and you catch the same size fish that he catches. Because you have the skills.
Preach.
You have the skills. And I've proven that many times, that it's knowledge, skills, and effort. That's always been the Bucher model, right? The more you learn, the better you get at the sport, and the harder you work, the luckier you get. All that said, though, one body of water, it's like hunt. Do any of you three guys hunt?
I used to a good bit,
Okay.
but
Well, I'm big into hunting trophy whitetails. But you can put a lot of time in Vilas County, Oneida County, trying to shoot a 150 class buck. And it can be done, but you're not going to shoot a lot of them. You take that same amount of time and that same amount of skill, and you go to Buffalo County, where I live, Buffalo County, the western side of Wisconsin, you're going to shoot one every year. You guys, the skill level you guys have, will only get you so far with the resource. And the resource can only give you so much. And that's why, like I said, take you guys and put you guys on a body of water that's got lots of fish over 50, you're going to catch them. Because they're there and you have the skills to catch them. So it's one of those things that you have to be very careful. If you're on a really good football team that's got a lot of really good players, you're going to make it to the big game, right? But Josh Allen can't do it all by himself. You have to have a team. You have to have to get to the big game. And it's the same thing even with fishing. is the potty water. You know, it's look at Green Bay. You know, you put all that time on Green Bay. Will you catch less fish? Yeah, but the average fish you catch could be a lot better. And are there still some big ones? You know, some big fish in those bodies of water and all those stuff? Absolutely. Absolutely, you bet. And even those surrounding areas, you know, the UP and some of those other areas and those offbeat little spots just outside of Vilas and Oneida County, there's some big fish in some of those spots. And you just gotta, you know, bide your time. And you guys, one of the things you guys have going for you that, you know, until recently we were suspended muskies. You go out and fish for them, and we'd have some success with them. But you couldn't actually, there they are. You know what I mean? You fish, you catch one, and then, you know, you'd fish a lot of random water and you wouldn't catch anything because you just had no way of knowing where they were. Now, with forward-facing sonar and side imaging, you can find them. And that's, you know, that's one of the things, by the way, I do in saltwater and everything too. I don't have forward-facing sonar, but I use side imaging a lot, but I do understand. You know, how big walleyes, big redfish, big muskies, you know, they cruise that open water away from traditional spots, and most people aren't making a cast at them or making a trolling pass at them.
Right. So now that you brought up open water muskies, I actually have a question for you here. So, back in the day, even if it was pre any sonar, green box, that type of thing, or when you first had some kinds of sonar and it started to develop a little bit, in that early season, that post spawn time frame, I'm sure, like you said, pressure was less, a good amount of muskies, not as many musky anglers. Musky fishing was great, but did you notice the time in that post spawn, just kind of call it June-ish time frame, where you maybe didn't see as many of those big females and you did have to do a little bit of open water hunting? Like, where did that kind of come in, or did you even need to do that?
Didn't need to do it, but we but didn't need to do it, but we saw those fish. What tipped me off on them was seeing them porpoise.
Yeah.
You know, those
Yeah,
lakes,
right.
you know, and when I was still in Boulder Junction, you know, be working the boat and clients are fishing over a spot, and all of a sudden, you know, you see one porpoise out there. And I just say, hey, turn around, throw one off, you know, throw one at 3 o'clock off the other side. What's out there? Just a muskie. I just saw a muskie porpoise. Throw it out there, and, you know, once in a blue moon, boom, you smack one and go, wow. Then you drive over there with your sonar, you look over there and go, there's no reef here, there's no weeds here, there's no, what was that fish doing out there? So that was, you know, kind of the start, you know, that, yeah. So that, you know, we did that. That's how we started to connect with suspended fish early, at least in my career. Way back then too, Gus, there was a guy that I used to see all the time in the Boulder Junction area. I wrote about him back in the early days of Fishing Facts, and his name was Bob Ellis. He was a row troller.
Okay, yeah, I recognize that name.
Yeah, and he was like the father of row trolling, okay, of row trolling muskies. It's not that nobody else ever row trolled, but Bob specifically row trolled the open water. One line, you know, no outboard in the boat, little small boat, and he was a older fella, and he would throw one crankbait out the back and, you know, put the rod between his legs and roll down the middle of the lake, and, you know, Bob Ellis's name would show up in the Vilas County Muskie Marathon every year with a top 10 fish. You know, and I got to know Bob at the boat landings and talk to him on the water and just wave at him as we going by, and occasionally became really good friends, and I ended up doing a series of articles on him that, you know, kind of in a way exposed his techniques and you know, and the suspended muskie thing. And the first article I ever did on him, by the way, was called "Suspended Muskies: The Last Frontier." That was back in the early days of Fishing Facts, and that was so revolutionary when I wrote that article and about Bob Ellis and those suspended fish. And of course, nowadays, you know, it is the last frontier, and everybody's, you know, there's a lot of guys tapping into it. But yeah, that's the way we started with that. And Tony Rizzo and I both, and some of the the other well-known musky guides in my era
Right.
did do some open water musky fishing. Not trolling much because trolling wasn't allowed back then, except rowing, but just drifting and casting and bomb casting for these fish. And it's pretty amazing because I still remember one of the first big topwater fish, a big suspended fish we caught. It was caught by an old man on a Fluger globe over 50 feet of water.
Love
This is pre-top reader days. This is earliest part of Booker Tail days, and this old guy, I'm thinking his name was Bill Weber. Bill, anyways, he's throwing a globe out there on a bright sunny day, and we not raising a thing, and all of a sudden, I said, Bill, a big one just porpoised out there over open water, and he says, where's it at? And I pointed that way, and he zoomed a cast out there, and again, over 35, 40, 50 feet of water. And he said, "Whoosh!" Get it? And it was like a 45, 46 incher. And it's like, the only fish we caught that day. And he was a hero, and he caught the fish over open water on a globe.
That's an incredible story. So you brought up a little bit ago, you brought up the resource of northern Wisconsin, and I'd be a little remiss if I didn't ask you and just get your thoughts on this, because you've lived through a lot of different rule changes and regulation changes and whatnot in northern Wisconsin. So obviously we just got hit with a pretty big one with the season opening on May 2nd this year. We talked about it in our last podcast. I think we have some reservations about it. We're younger though. We haven't lived through, these different eras. So I'd be curious to just get your thoughts, and we're constantly open to hearing new information and changing our mind. But I'd be curious to just kind of get your thoughts on what you think that means for the northern Wisconsin area moving forward, having the Wisconsin Muskie opener the first week of May.
I was there's part of me that is overly protective of the resource, no matter what it is, whether it's bass, walleyes, or muskies. And there's another part of me that is very sensitive to the economy and the businesses and everything that are trying to make a living. And I've always looked at how successful other areas are. I'm talking fishing in general now, fellas, but you can even target this to muskies as well now. Other areas in the country that have no close seasons and no close seasons, and they seem to do just fine. And restricting the harvest, there's catch and release only, catch and release only bass seasons, catch and release. Where I fish for redfish, for example. In Florida, you can catch all the redfish you want, but you can only keep one. And it can only be between, 18 and 27 inches. So you can catch all the giants you want all day long, but you can't keep any. Does that stop you from going out and enjoying the day and catching the fish and being part of the whole fishing economy, gas in the boats, stopping in marinas and buying gear and fishing tackle and staying at lodges, and you see where I'm going with this? Is that people buy you guys, in a resort area, have such a small window to make a living. And when seasons are restricted and bag limits are restricted, for example, on other species like, that people love to take home and eat, like walleyes and whatever, those things can really hurt the economy when people are coming there to fish. And back when I was your age, the fishing economy in the spring, for example, was gigantic. Opening day of fishing was a major happening. Opening day of deer hunting and opening day of fishing was like, it's a holiday. It was so fish opening day of fishing in general used to be so big, guys, that you had to buy your live bait. A day, the day, the night before, you they'd be sold out. There'd be so many people, places would be full. And I'm talking more general, but where I'm going with this is I'm more. I've always been this way, where I'm more on the let people fish, protect the resource by restricting what they can keep. And, you know, the catch and release bass season, for example, now, which is now what? Oh, it's year round, right?
Yep.
I don't think that's affected. It's probably not affected the bass fishing at all, because it's, you know, it's like it, bass fishing has been open in a lot of these other great areas all over the country, and there hasn't been a closed season for them. And as long as you restrict what they can keep, and that goes with him, you know, people going out, you know, the four of us go out and we keep, you know, we keep each keep 25 to 50 crappies. Well, after a week, we wiped out the school, you know. But if you go out and you can only keep four or five of them, or, you know, or 10 of them, whatever, and then you use, you know, and at the same time, you practice a little restraint on your own, a little conservation on your own, you can go out and enjoy the resource. Now, how does this pertain to muskie fishing and this earlier opening? Well, what are we worried about? Are we worried about people snagging them? That used to be a problem, by the way. It used to be a bigger problem.
I've heard about that no matter the regulation, though.
Yeah, that used to be a bigger problem, fellas, when they were catch and keep. In the catch and keep years, snagging was a big issue. But I'm not so sure that's even part of the deal anymore. But maybe it is. Are there always going to be poachers? Yeah. You got the same thing with, you know, look at what's happened with the, you know, you guys aren't big on the hunting thing, but man, they've liberalized archery hunting to a point where it's just, you know, gun hunting, rifle hunting for whitetails now is not as big a thing, because crossbows, the technology in crossbows has gotten so good, and they've liberalized who can use a crossbow. So a lot of people have given up a rifle and they're hunting longer seasons and hunting with a crossbow. They're harvesting more deer, yes, but it's been good for the economy. So, you know what I mean? There's this argument, and then there's the conservation argument. And somewhere in between is probably, you know, there's always going to be somebody who's not happy with this. I see it from an economic standpoint. It's good. It's good for lure sales. You know, it's going to be good for my buddies who are running Joe Booker Tackle Company and all our competitors most of the competitors, by the way, you know, I've always looked at most of the competitors in the industry as they're not enemies. You know, back when I had the magazine, when I ran Muskie Hunter magazine, I wanted all those people to be part of the magazine and be advertisers and be writers and be part of it. Cause I wanted to, I know I had a dream way before we ever had the Muskie sports shows. I had a dream that we would have Muskie sports shows. And now we do. We have them in every major city now. You know, you got to be able to go to these shows and, you know, say hello to this guy or say hello to that guy. And, you know, I mean, if the people from Chaos Tackle, for example, you know, Vince is a good friend of mine. I've never really looked at, even though some people probably looked at my company that way. I've never looked at the industries where we're all, you know, like enemies, or, you know, you can't use this guy's stuff, or, you know, that guy's no good. We're all trying to make a living in this business and trying to make sure that we retain and maintain the sport and the integrity of the sport. I'll tell you, you can make a much bigger argument than this early opening, make a much bigger argument against the forward facing sonar than you can for this season opening thing. So, and I don't know if we want to go there, because I've talked about that so much, and I know you guys have probably spent a ton of time talking about that on other podcasts. But you know, forward-facing sonar is interesting. You know, it's created a. I think that's a bigger threat than an early musky season ever would be.
Yeah,
yeah,
we tend to agree. Yeah, that's why. Scares me that now there's an extra month to use forward facing sonars, so that kind of go hand in hand. But
real quick, Brian, and I know this probably feels like shifting gears, but you brought up some interesting stuff with competitors, as you know, friends in the industry and different bait makers and stuff. And I've asked this to other people, even small batch bait maker guys, you know, when they kind of create their line of baits and they're out there using them. I've always wanted to ask you this, and I honestly do not know the answer. Has Joe Booker ever throwing a bulldog, a Medusa. Have you ever fished, or have you just kind of used your products ever since you started the tackle company?
Just use my products.
That's all. I mean, it's in a sense, it's like respect, because we get total bait. We get enamored by all the different lures, right?
Sure.
And and I've always just wondered, like, if you're able to use the stuff at in your toolkit, for different situations, and you've been able to kind of, it sounds like, just dial that in and master it.
Well, and at the same time, I do understand that and that the soft plastics, the Medusas and the Bulldogs, stuff like that, definitely have have a role that is, and it's a genre and a category that our companies missed on. At the same time, the guys who were running the company, if it was still back when my wife and I ran it, we would have probably been aggressive at developing something like that, but by the time, that stuff really started to catch, really catch, favor with anglers, we were out of it. We weren't doing it anymore. And my allegiance to the lure, to the brand has always been, I can catch enough fish on the lures I make. And I'll tell you, to be honest with you, that's one of the things that I've always really, endears me to Chaz. Has endeared me to Chaz because the dude has been a true blue hardcore. I'm going to catch him on JB on Joe Booker tackle, Joe Booker outdoors. He's going to catch him on our products no matter what. And he's found ways to catch him on depth readers and shallow readers and top readers and glide readers and Booker tails and slot masters. That's a pretty wide range of tools, we're really missing the soft plastics part of it, yeah. But in when it comes to everything else, we pretty much got a pretty good selection of tools there to cover a lot of things. And are the new guys, by the way, the new guys are dynamite. And by the way, I should let you guys know the guys that took Joe Booker Tackle Company over are all into high quality, small run. Small batch, build every lure, bulletproof guys. They're musky anglers. The two guys that run the business, they're hardcore musky guys, and that's the reason I sold to them. That's the reason I sold to them. And it's I didn't want to sell my lure company to a big brand. I'm sure you heard the story now. The three some of the other brands all sold to one party. Well, I never wanted to do that because once you do that, you become part of something really big that you kind of lose some identity. And especially when you get multiple brands kind of clashing with each other, and then you get some CEO at the top that goes, well, that get rid of that one, get rid of that one. Then it, we're not going to deal with this anymore. We're going to cut this, we're going to do that, we're going to save costs here. I never wanted that for our company. That's why I was always very protective of who I had running the company, even when Beth and I got out of it. Was it always run correctly? No. Did they always do it the way we would have done it? No. I'm pretty confident, though. Pretty confident. The guys that it took me a few swings at the bat, but the guys I got running it now, pretty confident they're going to do it the way we did. And arguably take on, they're going to take the advice of young anglers like yourselves and go, hey, we need, I would not be surprised at all if they could get in the soft plastic business now and do something very neat, unique and original. But like I said, they're all about high quality, small batch, field testing, water testing and leak testing in the beginning and then before they even paint it and then checking them again and they're just dynamite guys, and I love everything's made locally, it's checked and double checked and triple checked, and that's what I was really hoping would happen this time, and it did happen. So didn't want to go down that that soapbox too much, but I did want you guys to know that though. We never had problem issues with the Booker tail because that lure is pretty much bulletproof, as you guys know. That 500 tinsel you guys have talked about catching so many fish on, that kind of stuff, spinners are. when you build them right, they're pretty bulletproof. But you start getting in all this other stuff, you know, a lot of things can go
Right.
wrong if you don't build them right. And
Yeah. And that, I mean, I think, in any sense of business, when companies change hands, things are going to be different from when the person that started that company and put their blood, sweat, and tears and original ideas. It's too hard to copy, right? Or continue to do the exact
Well,
same things the
the other thing
previous
that
people.
happens too is the other thing that happens too is that when you get as big as we got, you go from building a few hundred gates to you're building thousands, tens of thousands. Now you got a lot of people involved and a lot of hands on those things, and not all of them are as skilled as, the guy who's building 100. And now they're building.
Right.
Now, when you're building 10,000 of them, or 1,000, or 10,000 of them, a lot of things can go wrong. And once they go wrong, they get built 10,000 wrong. And
Right.
really got a problem. So, that's why this attention to small detail and small batch building is really going to be great. And but yeah, in getting back to answering your questions, yeah, I dedicated myself to the brand. If I didn't believe in what I designed, and I designed all those things, so if I didn't believe in the design of them, no, did I ever experiment with, with and mess around with other things? Yes, I had to. Those gave me ideas, especially spinnerbaits. The first Slopmaster spinnerbait, for example, I designed was a bass lure. And then I
Right.
built it larger for muskies.
So do you have any, so like I know, for example, we got a couple I mentioned that the few Booker Tail Tinsel 500s that are still, some of them original to the ones we got years ago. And I know Gus has got a couple depth raters in his box that the wheels are falling
Couple.
off of those things. Yeah, just lots of depth raters in his boxes where the paint's falling off and they're, so do you have any, specific ones that for whatever reason, one way or another, that you've just hung on to because they're either lucky or can you think of any depth raters in your box that, oh, this one's responsible for so many muskies that you've just held on to, and for whatever reason, one way or another, it was a color pattern, it was the way it was built or something, just made it really pop.
Well, what's really interesting about that part particular, we're gonna go down that route, right? Down that road, right?
Yeah, let's
And
do it.
on that rabbit hole, the guys that have been fishing depth raters a really long time, want them built the way Beth and I built them when the lures were made out of a product, out of a plastic product called butyrate. And were the depth raters built different when Beth and I had the company? Yes. But that plastic we built them out of, we can't get it anymore. So, we that the first depth raters were built out of butyrate, which is the same plastic that they make wood ch you know chisel chisel handles off of, wood chisels. So you can beat them with a hammer. And I thought, what are they building that out of? That's what I want to build the depth raters out of. And so we built thousands of depth raters out of butyrate, shallow raters too, out of butyrate in the beginning. And then butyrate became more expensive and harder to get and harder to use and harder to mold with. And then the molder that we worked with wouldn't work with them anymore. So, to answer your question, I still have butyrate depth raters. I still have some. And maybe when I'm in my 80s, I'll make those available for, I'll give them to all you guys, and so you guys can have some originals. But
Oh boy.
were they different? Were they different? Yes, they were less buoyant. They were definitely tougher, but much harder to build. And I can't, the guys, like, for example, even Ken Robinson, who ran the company for many years, and now Terry and Mike, who run the company now, that was one of the first things Terry and Mike said: "Hey, can we build those lures out of that butyrate anymore?" Well, they've checked into it. They're going to be researching some new plastic materials to see if there's something that has the strength and the strength of the butyrate material. The lures are made out of a high impact ABS now. But have a lot of big fish been caught on ABS depth raters and shallow raters? Absolutely. Hundreds and hundreds of fish. Do they last as long? No. Do they do the job? Yeah. They're more buoyant. They make more noise. They wobble better than the original butyrates do. But the butyrates caught a lot of big fish too, you know. There are, and yes, I have a selection of, I have a top reader, you know, I have a top reader that I've talked about on my show. And Chaz used to just, you know, it used to drive him crazy when he'd see, he'd look and he'd go, "Oh man, dude, you bought black Bart on the trip. Black Bart. Says, can I fish with black Bart for an hour? Just for an hour?" And black Bart is an old top reader that's probably got, I mean, without exaggerating, black Bart's probably caught 15 over 50.
A good lure.
I have
Great
no
lure.
idea how many fish it's caught. I just, the reason it's called black Bart is I just, as soon as the paint comes off it, I spray paint it black again. And it's caught so many fish, it just keeps working. I change the hooks on it. And, it, you know, one of the things about a top reader, which is kind of funny, you know, is I get, you guys will appreciate this. You know, there's these guys that are talking, you know, recently about, you know, top readers were made with BBs in the tail a few years back, and those are way better than the ones made today. And it's so funny because Black Bart didn't have a BB in it. Larry the Loon, you know, was this original Loon top reader that I've got that's also caught
Larry
Larry the Loon, man.
Balloon.
Yeah, we've got some, you know, yeah, old Froggy. There's an old Froggy's original hand painted, you know, old Ducky top reader's original yellow top reader caught gazillions. None of those had a rattle in them, but you know, guys believe that makes a difference. What does make a difference in a top reader is a squeak,
Absolutely.
is a rivet, and it's, you know, you can take 100 top readers. And you can rotate them, and they'll all catch fish, but you'll find that one when you're casting, you can hear a little, you know, you hear a little metallic squeak to it. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and you hear that little metallic squeak, and you go, "Whoa!" And that's what Black Bart has.
Yeah.
You need to rename some of these colors this year. You need to get Black Bart on the box. You need to get the ducky.
You're
Black
right.
Bart would be an easy one.
Larry the Loon.
You're absolutely right, because it's funny because you know, the guy who owns the company now, Terry, he says, "Do you think Black Bart would even sell?" I says, "If you just paint it black, no. But if you put Black Bart on the package, I believe it will."
Yeah, the name is much
And what are you
better.
doing to it? You're just spraying it black, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, part of this is, you know, like as musky anglers, this is kind of part of the fun, right? I mean, just, you know, a lot of these lures, like whether, you know, one's a little different here, one's a little different there. Like you said, they all probably will catch fish. So if, you know, one's got a cool name and you got confidence and you're fishing it a bunch and you use it during prime time hours, you're naturally going to have probably more success stories with it. And I've had lures like that in the past. And it, for one reason or another, is it truly a better lure? I don't know. But it's got a nickname, it's got stories behind it, it's got war stories, and for whatever reason, that thing
You
have
know what?
confidence in.
Chaz is worse than me with nicknames on lures. Yeah, he is so funny with that, and he's got nicknames for a lot of his personal lures that, I mean, man. But yeah, he's funny that way, and he had an original pink 500 tinsel that he called Elton John. And he wanted
Think
us
I've heard
to
about
name
that
it,
one.
he wanted us to name the color Elton John, because we had Elvis, you know, Goldie.
Yeah. Oh,
He
yeah.
wanted to be called Elton John. But, you know, Ken was against the whole Elton John thing, and maybe there would have been some copyright issues and whatnot. So we were going to call it Rocket Man or something else, but we never did. But the dude has a pink 500 that he scored a lot of big fish on that bait, and it was Elton John. It was the first, and I tied it for him. I personally tied it for him. He's got a glide rater. He calls it Gus the Glide Rater.
Oh man, I don't think he told me about this one. Maybe he
Oh,
did.
Gus.
I have met the dude a few times.
Yeah,
Gus the Glide Rider.
you Gus, you gotta ask him about Gus the Glide Rider.
I have to next
Yeah,
time.
it's the one he got that he got a mid 40 pounder with me on it, and I hand built the Glide Rider, and it was one of the originals. I hand built it, I hand painted it, and even though he had all these beautiful production lures that worked just great, and some of them were better than the others, that original one that I built for him. That was his bait man, and he and you could it looks it doesn't look that good, but he throws it and he catches a ton of big fish on it.
It's awesome. Well, this is
Gus,
kind of
what was the
inspiring.
what was the fi oh go ahead.
What are you gonna ask
I
me?
just it wasn't a question. I just it was more of a funny comment. I What was the old Goldilocks 500 tinsel name that we used to call it,
Thanksgiving
like the
din. We called it
Thanksgiving
Thanksgiving
dinner?
dinner. Yeah, because it's got the cranberries and
The
the mashed
gold and
potatoes and the
brown,
gold and browns. We called it Thanksgiving dinner.
You're like, give me that Thanksgiving dinner bucktail.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving dinner bucktail.
Yeah. This is sparking, inspiration that I need to name this depth rater. I got up just a second ago to go grab these.
Ooh.
This perch one, which funny
Yep.
enough comes from these guys know this box really well. That's all you need
Money
to know
box.
about this box is that this is the
Money.
money trolling box. This depth rater comes out of it and my mistake. I actually ran it for a whole day and realized there was two clipped hooks from a previous fish that I never changed the hook on. But so where I'm getting at with this depth rater, is that this will spark something from you. And I know you've talked about it, and I kind of want to hear you if you got some thoughts on it again. This is, I don't know if Zoom's going to pick it up, but this jointed depth rater is completely offset on the tail, so it is. It's,
Yeah.
incorrect. It's not, it's imperfect. And this thing wiggles like no other depth rater I have because of this imperfection. And it has caught many large fish for me trolling.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah, it's, I don't know if you've seen that before where one is offset. So
That's
it.
interesting. So the joint on the back is not in the right spot. The wire form on the back is offset.
Yes. Yes,
Mm-hmm.
it is. It is not centered. Do you see it there now? That might show it the best.
Yeah.
That didn't just get bent like that from a fish, or was like that from the beginning?
Like that from the beginning. It always wiggled that way.
Well, there you
Well,
go.
you got lucky. That's a
But
good one.
that's what I mean. I got lucky and the first fish it caught,
Oh,
I think over 48, so
it's been a big score bait for you, huh?
absolutely. I don't think it's caught a fish under 40. I'm gonna be honest.
It
It's a big
had
fish
your
bait.
PB at one time, didn't it?
It's still my PB by weight, I would argue, but yes, it had my
Fantastic.
PB for over a year.
Fantastic. That is just awesome.
This is
Well, I
gonna
tell
need a
you
name.
guys, the fact that you guys are still using our lures, and that really kind of makes my day. And doing this podcast with you guys, it's just been an absolute blast, because you have your own history with the lure, and you have some appreciation for that. I'll tell you, comparing you with you guys, which at your age and what you're doing, again, you can see that Chaz has been very successful being, loyal to the brand. When he started to get into his own thing, when he was a guest, he started out as a camera guy in my show. I invited him to be a camera guy one year on our show, and I met him at a sports show when he was just a little tyke. And he got in front of the camera a couple times, and he did pretty good. And I realized he was a teacher. And once I started to talk about retirement, he kind of took things over, and he wanted us to sponsor him. And I was excited that he was able to, and still does, is have an allegiance to one brand like that. And you don't see much of that, but you can see, though, that the brand still the brand good lures, good techniques, good lures, it's timeless. They catch fish, and it's one of those things that those kind of things don't go out of style. Those kind of things just don't go out of style. One of my best big redfish lures in Florida is a lure that's older than me. Yeah, it's been around. I don't know how old it is. It's an old spoon. Spoons are big on these big bowl reds. And there's a spoon that was made, back in way back, it's Daredevil and Johnson spoon kind of like era. There was a spoon back then that, that's part of that family of old lures made back then. And it's still better than anything I've used today on those redfish down there. And so what I'm going with that is that I doubt that good fishing lures, no matter whose brand you're using and what you have confidence, I doubt that ever goes out of style. I just don't think it will. I just don't think it will because fishing's still fishing.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You piqued my interest with mentioning, potential new models
Yes.
under your company and with the new management that you have now. Is that for sure projects that are maybe coming out this year or just stuff that's in the, kind of to be determined in the development?
They're already starting some stuff,
Yeah,
like a new offset bladed Booker tail
yep,
offset.
they got the guys are pretty aggressive. They have a lot on their plate. The guys have a lot on their plate, to just transition over from, business that Ken ran all these years, transition all that inventory, and then build new products and kind of catch up with all the retailers and understand the business. So we've got to give these guys a year, but even then, yeah, they're coming up with a couple of things, but expect some really good things from them down the road that are beyond, stagger blade style bucktails and stuff like that. The new rhythm, the Booker tail rhythm pattern, which is essentially the whole, they're going to have a whole family of a 5 and a 7 together and a 7 and an 8 together and an 8 and a 10 together, with a special clevis on them. And they have been, field testing it, and showing me the results on Zoom calls and stuff like that. So,
Cool.
yeah, so yeah, they're doing a good job of that. But yeah, I can tell you this, that in my prototype form, in my prototype shop, pretty much everything that that you would ask for is already built. Smaller glide rates, bigger and smaller shallow rates, bigger and smaller jointed shallow rates, bigger and smaller depth rates, bigger and smaller top rates. All that stuff has been built in prototypes. But every single one of those lures, bringing those lures to marketplace, costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
It's
Right.
tooling. It's tooling that's a challenge. And they can only invest so much money in 1 year's time. And the best way for them to get new products out this year outside of colors was to do that new rhythm series, that new stagger blade rhythm series. And I'm sure they're going to be really successful with it. But don't be surprised if they come up with all kinds of things here down the road. And, when it comes to the depth rater and the shallow rater and the top rater and the slot master, slot master, had there's actually five, there's 4 or 5 sizes of the slot master that were already built. Two of them are available, in musky version, but there were smaller ones all the way down to a 1/4 ounce, that were originally built. So there's lots of stuff like that, but don't be surprised if these guys not only produce more of the same. It's hard to fix what ain't broke, and you don't have to reinvent the wheel with a lot of things. When they're a depth reader like that Gus has been so successful with, a depth reader, a jointed depth reader like that's a little bit bigger and a little bit smaller. Of course, the smaller jointed depth reader is an absolute killer, and it has been for so many people for years. A larger depth reader, very, very, very possible. But these guys, I wouldn't surprise me if they do some things that'll surprise everybody,
That'd be cool. Yeah.
especially in soft plastics and stuff. But it's just they gotta let the paint dry first on what they're doing right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is exciting though. I mean,
Yes.
I'm very pumped. I'm looking forward to meet Mike in person. I think he's gonna
Yes.
go to some shows. I've been talking with him a little bit and he's been very polite and asking some, opinions on things. So
Well,
I'm
you'll really
excited.
enjoy Mike in person. And Mike's a user. Mike's a, Mike, you know, he's a musky hound just like you guys are. And He was a
Good.
long-time customer of Chaz's, by the way, and that's how he found out about the company being for sale, and being in a transition. And he was out fishing with Chaz, and Chaz mentioned it to him, and
No kidding.
and that's how that's that. Yeah, there's a story for your podcast that nobody else knows about yet, is that the whole thing with Mike and Terry happened through an outing with Chaz Martin. And when you get the chance, I'm sure you probably meet Mike. If you guys get to the Central Wisconsin show in March, you probably meet Mike and Terry.
Yeah, for sure. They'll have a booth at Wausau. Yes, I did see
They'll
that.
eventually have booths at all the shows.
Oh,
When
that's
they,
cool.
yeah, they, you know, they just, I don't, some of the shows they couldn't get into, they were booked. I think that, even and just developing a budget for shows, they couldn't gear up for a show yet. They couldn't gear up for a show till March. They just couldn't get there from, they weren't ready in January. I mean, I don't know if you saw some of the promotions they've done, but the promotions they've done, they sold out of some of those lures like hours. It's
No
fantastic what
kid.
they.
Yeah. Well,
Well,
we'll be doing a live podcast at the show in March, so maybe we'll have to have him on when we sit down and do that live podcast.
I think you'll enjoy these guys. They're very down to earth, and they're Mike will fit right in with you guys because he's just a musky crazy guy. And there's a story about Terry that's a story that's really special, and I want to tell that story in really in detail someday, because it involves some pretty special things on how Terry ended up being, the main guy that bought the company. And I want to save that story. Let's say when the story becomes available, if you guys want to do a podcast together on that story, it'd be really special, because
Yes.
Terry is, Terry's a big reason why I sold the company to those guys. He's really a special guy. Let's put it this way, there's some cool background behind Terry. And
Cool.
it's really special. So, but I really enjoyed this, guys. This was fun.
Absolutely, I did too. I think we can. I mean, golly, there's a lot more we probably could go on, and we can easily save this for another chat. When you want to talk about that story. But this has been awesome. Thank you so much, Joe, for your
Oh,
time
my pleasure.
to
My
chat.
pleasure. Pleasure's all mine, guys, and the best of luck to you guys. Like I say, you guys made my day talking about some of the success you guys have had with the lures. And I wish you guys all the success with your podcast. And feel free to contact me. Not only you got my phone number, and feel free to contact me with a text or whatever if you got any questions about anything, or you want to do another cast down the road sometime. And hope you guys catch some big fish. And
Us too.
safe travels to you guys and all the things you do. And God bless you and your families.
Cool. Thanks, Joe.
Appreciate it,
Really
Joe.
appreciate
Yeah,
it. And
it's a
enjoy the
blast.
country music in Nashville for a little bit longer here.
Thanks,
Yeah.
guys.
Thank you.